Thanks, Jan. I hope you got an appreciation for sort of the depth of the thinking and the depth of the strategies in the business. I mean, you had literally a number of domain experts in front of you today. You know, Jan has been running our services business for a long time in Europe, and he's got a background in consulting from McKinsey Corporation. Pascal's worked in diagnostic imaging. The pharma company is a molecular biologist. So when she shows you all these things, she knows what she's talking about here. Vishal has had a career in IT, specifically healthcare IT, building our PACS business. Omar has built a $5 billion clinical systems business and ultrasound business for the company and is now really making sure that we have a great global HCS portfolio and taking responsibility for clinical systems and DI. When you talk about Marcelo, he's a great global leader. He's worked in Brazil and developing markets. We've had him working for us in China for a while now. But you've got a number of people up here that are really domain experts in their respective field and are capable of getting into the strategies at a very, very deep level. I hope you got an appreciation for where we want to take this business. On top is sort of the financial expression. That's our expectation of ourselves. That's what we want to do in this business. And down below are the strategies that we're employing to make that happen. Again, healthy imagination is more than just a marketing campaign. It's a mission statement. It's the way we think about the business. It's the way we invest in the business. We think we've got a great clear shot at the developing markets, and we are putting assets and people investments on the ground to take full advantage of that opportunity, because I respect that opportunity. You don't get it in all industries. We've got a great service model, and I think we can build that out, and we're showing that we can add very productive levels to that. We know what product excellence is. We know what a great portfolio is, and Omar's going to make sure that we have that in HCS. Healthcare IT is a multi-inning game. We've done well in the first couple innings, particularly in the departmental side, and we think we're positioned for where it's going in the future. And we expect the next couple of years to be much more exciting in that space. Life sciences, great asset, truly dominant in its field. We want to continue to expand that footprint. And then molecular diagnostics is probably one of the more interesting and exciting things to happen in healthcare in a long time. And we want to be on the front end of that change. So with that, I'll ask the team to come up and join me on the stage, and we'll field any questions or clarifications that you may need after today's discussion. And apparently we have a few of them. So are we going to do a microphone, hand a microphone out? Okay, you want to start with Nicole?
Thanks. John, you painted a really robust outlook for the next 5-10 years as you look at all the growth opportunities. Can you give us a sense of what you're worried about from a challenges perspective? Is it customer pricing pressure? Is it R&D allocation? Is it technology adoption? How do you think about the biggest risk to the business?
You know, the biggest risks out there are just, you can't, we don't know what's going to happen with economies, and anybody who tells you they know what's going to happen with the economies, they don't know what they're talking about. We're in an environment where it's tough to say what's going to happen to every independent economy over time. We do feel better about healthcare relative to that. As I said, you just go back to the fundamentals of the demand, and there are very strong signals. Our biggest challenge is placing the right bets. I've never seen a business where there are so many different technologies and so many different opportunities. So we've got to have a lot of discipline on where we place our bets and which ones we pick. I think healthy imagination has helped us with that. We've made some significant investments, not just in healthcare, but in the company, in improving our marketing and business development operations, so we have an external view of the world. But picking the right shots is really the hardest thing, because there are a lot of them in this space. Who's that?
Thanks, John. One thing that struck me when I was visiting the China operations particularly was the speed of technology change that is, as you say, driving, in-country, for-country product areas. And the concern I raised at the time, and I still would love to get a better comfort level with it, is over a longer time period, what gives you confidence that, like a lot of other industries, is that technology changes so rapidly, you're able to pace the cost side, the pricing side, so you don't face more pricing pressure, so you don't face cannibalization in your in your core markets, that it's sort of segment-specific, and that as you find better ways to provide health care in those segments, in those locations, they don't come back to health systems under cost pressure here and elsewhere.
Yeah, you know, I think the most comforting thing to me is past experience, because everything else is kind of a guess. And when I look back into our experiences and I say, you know, what makes us feel good about what can happen, you know, with a portfolio as we expand it and we broaden it into the lower price points, I look at the ultrasound business. That is a business that Omar's built that, as he showed you, around the world has tripled over the last 10 years. The average pricing of an ultrasound unit has dropped 50%. The margin rate has improved 10 points. I like that financial expression. That works for me. I think it works for you. So there are parts of our business where we've seen that. And then the other part of it is just philosophy, which is we got to go where the market is. You know, we're not going to walk into those new markets with expectations that this is a less profitable marketplace. And that's not the case with China. We see the same levels of profitability in our China business that we see in the developed markets. It often surprises people.
I can just add to that a little bit, in the sense that this is something we're expecting. We know that there's going to be a price pressure in those markets, and so we're planning for it. And we've got technology in our pipeline that we know today, coming out in the next 5 years, that'll take us there. So I'm, you know, close to certain that we can keep our margin rates where they have to be, because we're working on it today. Our R&D activities as much around those areas of how to improve, like I talked about architecture, how to improve performance and lower cost dramatically at the same time as it is about, you know, pushing the next envelope in image quality or something.
I just say, because we're a pretty global company, we spend, Marcelo and Omar and the product teams, they spend a lot of time looking at the new competitors. We're just paranoid of the new competitors. So we spend a lot of time at the shows in every country saying, you know, who are these new players, in certain geographies that are coming out? What do they have and what's their advantage and how do we compete against them? Because it'd be very easy to just stand back and look at the multinationals and think about what they're doing and miss something very disruptive in China or India. And we pay a lot of attention. Yeah. I'd say Omar's and his team are damn near paranoid. They spend as much time thinking about the little players as they do the big players, and they don't want to get caught up there.
And you talked a lot about productivity for your customers,
yeah,
and in driving products and services that enhance your customers' economics and profitability. What about your own productivity inside the business unit? Could you talk a little bit about where that has been and where you are taking it, separate from operating leverage?
Yeah.
Okay.
Two forms of productivity. One, we continue to just simplify the footprint. So we have a dramatic decrease in the number of factories, warehouses, offices. I mean, we're really reducing the footprint by 20 or 30%. We've gone through an enormous amount of restructuring. Last year, we completely reset the bar in terms of our indirect cost structure and the run rates there. And then on variable cost productivity, our labor productivity and probably more importantly, our material cost productivity in the product lines has been improving considerably. So we spend a great deal of time working the variable cost productivity side of the guide of the business from a product design standpoint. That's what Omar talked a lot about. But we've done a lot to reset the footprint cost structure as well. And some of that has been pure savings that you've seen in the leverage. A lot of that's been reinvested in building the architectures in the developing markets that Marcelo talked about. Yep.
Thanks. So I want to pick up on the emerging markets and declining price point theme. Right? It's clear that if you look at companies like Mindray, they obviously don't have your level of product sophistication, but they are driving at a low but pretty broad scale level, right? A lot of product that's pretty cheap.
Yeah.
And presumably over time that will become more sophisticated. What are your price points relative to that sort of mass entry level of the market? Are you there? And I guess the other sort of corollary is, Have you been able to drive so much price down but maintaining profitability because of effectively there's so much electronic content, right, that effectively, you know, we all know you even referenced Moore's Law. We know what happens on the electronic side. Is this going to face some sort of limiting returns type of contribution because you just benefited so much from cheaper electronics, but that just doesn't go on forever? If you could maybe tie those two things together, I'd be interested in that.
We can continue to radically change the architecture, and it's not just beating at the rock. It's really going from an MR design like that to an MR design like that, where you just rethink the architecture completely. It's like going from a personal computer to an iPad to an iPhone, and that analogy is a good one because in our business, we are an electronics player, but we're also the software architect. And we're able to port some of this very high-end software capability from the most sophisticated designs down to the lower-cost architecture. So that gives us an opportunity to play at a different price point, but to bring some very sophisticated software capabilities to that price point and do things that are very, very disruptive. So you know, it's not just banging away at the fundamental electronics cost. It's really rethinking the architectures, and I think you're seeing some real and particularly in Omar's disruptive side about what we're doing in MR and what we've done with the V-scan and ultrasound about changing the architecture. I'll leave it to Omar to talk a little bit about the min rate point. But
yeah, no, I think we're competing against companies like Minray at all price points. At all price points they have, and in fact, we intend, depending on what our customers want, we intend to set the agenda based on what our customers want. Whatever price point is needed for that marketplace, we intend to compete in it and be profitable at it. Minray is a data point in that. And
how many competitors do you have in ultrasound?
Yeah, in China alone, there's 100 companies. There's 100 Chinese companies, and they're all trying to go after that space. And we're a leader in that. You look at the numbers, we're by far the biggest player in the lower end of the segment, not to speak of the high end. So we think we can compete now. Again, you know, in some businesses we're stronger than others, and but we have an aspiration to be as good as that in every single business unit in every country in the world. And so that's the way we look at it, and we look at it by looking first at our customers and their needs, and then look at the environment around us and what the competitors are doing.
It's a competitive space. It's always been a competitive space that doesn't. Things aren't changing structurally in a very big way.
I just want to add a comment, John. And it's not just about the product. You need to think about the cost point. You need to think about after-sale service. That's mm-hmm. critical for that market. They sweat to buy a machine. Now they need to keep it running. Mm-hmm. The second is there's shortage of doctors on this transformation there. So you need to be aligned with the government on the effort of educating doctors. So there are several other parameters that differentiate you and require much more than just a cost point on the product to be able to win on a market like that. And we've been positioned for that. So, yeah, we pay attention to the competition, but we also try to be always ahead on the curve on other parameters that make us more successful in the future.
You don't see limiting.
Not really. Let me try to address that, give you some more specific examples to kind of embellish that point a little bit. You know, one of the main techniques that we use to do this is what we call hardware to software transformation. So an architecture may be driven by hardware at one point, but because of increased computing horsepower, a lot of that work can then be done in software. So that has two huge advantages for us. One, obviously, it drives a lower cost point because the cost of the hardware is far less. Second, which is a very important point, is that when we get to a global platform, which is software-driven, we can migrate algorithms and technologies that we've developed for the high-end, high-quality markets and bring it in lower cost in a lower-cost platform for targeted use in an emerging market or equally for a niche need somewhere. That ability to seamlessly move algorithms that are developed for sophisticated markets and target them, not just sort of broad brush, but target them for specific needs, is in the end our key differentiating advantage. And we think that progression has a lot of runway left.
And you have to think a little bit. I mean, your question's a good one. People worry philosophically about, you know, mixing down. And instead of somebody buying a $1 million CT, they buy a $400,000 CT. The reality is it's the CTs aren't competing with each other. somebody's buying that low-cost CT instead of buying an X-ray system because now they can get the power. They're really often buying up. The other thing that happens is the people that buy up into a handheld ultrasound had nothing before.
Yeah.
They were midwives in India, China. So in essence, you end up creating markets, and you end up often cannibalizing what's under you, not your high-end portfolio to get there. That's been the pleasant surprise with a lot of these products. It's not that you're competing against the expensive CT. It's you're giving somebody an opportunity to raise the level of diagnostic performance for a few dollars more. You end up taking it from X-ray. Yeah. You pass the... Just grab the microphone next time he walks by.
You got a Six Sigma, this microphone handout. John, one of the slides that you put up that really jumped out at me was the growth vision for the business overall. And it wasn't too long ago you talked about this business being a 3-5% top-line grower, and we're seeing today 5-10%.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty short time frame from when we were at 3-5%. So, you know, is there any under-promising earlier, or this is a real step function in growth. So which businesses are making the biggest contribution?
Yeah, you know, it's and my boss reminds me all the time, but we've been making a lot of investments in this business. Even last year, when we were in probably one of the most challenging environments we've ever been in, we've been putting a lot of money into the product lines, both in the short and mid-term, as well as the long-term. We really expect to do this with new products and new technologies. We're not depending a lot on a radical change in the marketplace, but you know, frankly, I don't think they're going to get much worse, and they could get better. But we really think that because of the new investments and new technologies, some of the things that we've added to the business, we can grow organically.
You wouldn't cite one particular business as...
You know, I think if you look at every one of these businesses, they're showing you short-term improvements to the portfolio. Omar showed you our MR portfolio is better. Our CT portfolio is better. But then we're also making some investments that we think will change the business 4 to 5 years out, like Quilibria and Home Health. So we've got some good things coming midterm and some good things coming long-term. And that's what makes us feel more bullish is the investment. It's a product business. It's a technology business. And if you think you've got better technologies coming, you get more bullish. And that's what's driving it.
And then as a quick follow-up for Omar, I was surprised you were able to get through a presentation without talking about reimbursement pressure. So where does that stand? How much is a driver for developing products that have lower price points and more specialty applications?
I think that's a good question. And actually, we think a lot about that. But what's important to point out is that, first, we think globally. And reimbursement is a local phenomenon, so it happens differently in different countries. So our mindset is reimbursement is a factor, but the bigger factor is our customers' cost position and the quality of care that they're providing and the access that they provide that they have to their patients around what we mentioned around Health Imagination. So we zero in much more on the customer's absolute needs, and then we figure out where does reimbursement play a role in that? Because in some markets, India, for example, it's patient-paid. 98% of India is self-paid. That's a market we're interested in, 98%. And so there are lots of markets which work differently. Again, reimbursement is a factor which we have to be cognizant of. But, you know, when we develop new products, we kind of try to determine up front, for this product to be successful, does it require reimbursement change? And if that's required, we put the money up front to do the clinical trials that are necessary to convince the authorities to change reimbursement. But we were thinking much more intelligently about that upfront and putting it much more in perspective as a factor in the overall equation of our customers' business.
Mike. So, John, so just to clarify, the 5-10%, that's organic. That doesn't include any M&A.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So, obviously, you expressed a desire to be the leader across your portfolio. You're not quite there yet. Healthcare multiples are really cheap right now.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you think about M&A? Do you see an opportunity to be a bit more aggressive with maybe one or two larger deals than maybe you've communicated in the last 12 to 24 months?
Yeah, we could be more aggressive, but we don't have a size, not large, small. We're really looking at various technologies in the portfolio. So some of the technologies that we're building out the molecular diagnostics side, on Jan's side, there are always opportunities in Omar's portfolio, and we could have some global opportunities in Vishal's portfolio. So across the whole business, there are some nice opportunities. But I'm not necessarily looking out for some big acquisition to fundamentally change the scope of the business. We like the areas we're in, and we want to expand our competitiveness in those particular areas right now.
And then just a follow-up to that, I mean, with Clariant, it clearly looks like there's good synergies between in vitro and in vivo. But what about things like, you know, bringing forward the pipeline, you know, bringing forward that pipeline, you know, accelerating the time to market, and maybe Salesforce expansion? Can you maybe talk about those two areas?
Absolutely. I mean, and the things that we're excited about there is that's obviously a very domestic model. We're going to pull them in, sit down with our international teams, each one of our business leaders, and say, how quickly and where should our priorities be in terms of globalizing that model? And with our GRC teams, we want to continue to add to that pipeline. And we think we're going to see some synergies between Pascal's in vivo pipeline, because you use some of the same components in the molecules, particularly the ligands. We may be able to share some technologies between the two. So those are exactly the two areas that we think about when we look at that, is how do we expand that thing commercially, domestically, internationally, and how do we charge that pipeline with proprietary diagnostics? Because it's very important that we keep that, very rich proprietary pipeline.
I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah,
I've been spending quite a lot of time on this.
Yeah, yeah. No, we love that asset, and we think it's just going to be a wonderful complement to Pascal's business.
Yeah, I think I would just add on the technologies that we were developing. I mean, Clariant was really showing the importance of some of the technologies that we had in development with digital pathology in Vishal's business and molecular pathology at the Global Research Center that could actually bring a lot more efficiency in this space. And Michel mentioned that I did not insist as much, but this is really a space that is pretty much where radiology was 30 years ago, and there are a lot of technologies where the capabilities and the competences that we have can actually translate pretty well. So we feel good about that, that came kind of on top of the in vivo and in vitro fit, if you like. But that actually works pretty well, and we are pretty excited about the potential there.
Give this guy the microphone. He's been waiting very patiently.
I have it here.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to have to wait a little more.
Too bad.
Just a question on the op profit target. When you were at 3-5% on the top line, you were saying 5-10 op profit, and now we've gone 5-10, but we're at a flat 10. I mean,
yeah.
Should I be reading in that, you know, as you get to, you know, faster top line growth, you start to reinvest some, or is that?
Yeah, I mean, we continue on the reinvestment. This year we've gotten even more leverage because a significant amount of restructuring in last year's number. So we may do more restructuring, but that's not baked in.
I mean, is that sort of a policy, like, you know, we're happy with 10 and then we have all these opportunities, we'll start to plow it back in, or we don't want it to flow up to 15?
I'm not at all familiar with that stop at 10 policy. But that's our expectation at this point. We can do better than that, we will.
There we go.
So services operations have been a significant contribution to earnings. Where do you see yourself, let's say, going over the next few years in terms of a major contribution to earnings of the corporation? That's question number one. And number two, it looks to me like there's a lot of poverty in the world, a lot of problems, health problems in some of the lesser developed countries.
Yeah.
What are you doing in that area in terms of, let's say, making an important competitive niche in the market?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the financial projections and the growth and really the size of the business now it allow us to make a material contribution to the industrial side of the business. I'm sure everyone will push us to do even more in the future. I'd say on the in terms of what we can do in developing markets and poverty-stricken markets around the world, I think the best story, the best example is probably what you're doing in Bangladesh, Omar. Why don't you just, as a vignette, to talk a little bit about how we're using our technology, microfinancing, to change healthcare in Bangladesh?
Yeah. First, along those lines, our view of addressing poverty, if you like, or healthcare in those markets, is to create sustainable, economically sustainable solutions. So not just charity. In other words, take expensive equipment and dump it over there and think something will happen, but instead use our technology to create solutions that are sustainable economically in that environment. So the example that John is talking about is one where we've looked at the maternal mortality index as a measurement, right? So this is the survival rate of women through the pregnancy period. And in the developing world, it's a factor of 30 lower than, say, in the developed world. That's the kind of gap we're talking about. So a lot more women die from known causes during the period of pregnancy and childbirth in these areas. So one way of alleviating that is to detect who is going to have these problems early, and through that manage their condition much better. A lot of these women die because they just don't have access to transportation. You know, there's a breech baby. They don't know that the baby is going to be breech. All kinds of bleeding occurs. They need a cesarean section, and someone's carrying them in a stretcher and walking for 30 miles, and, you know, obviously, you know, the outcome is not good. If you can detect that up front, you can manage that condition earlier. You've got 9 months to manage this thing. You can take this patient to the hospital and provide better care. So detection there is an important criteria. So what we've done is in combination with Grameen Microfinance, who you must have heard of, using their clinics in Bangladesh as an infrastructure and their access to women as a further asset, we're deploying targeted ultrasound products that will be used by community health workers to do early detection and triaging of patients during the course of their pregnancy, and then these patients can be managed better. Now, what we're also doing is, with the help of Grameen, helping these community workers to, in fact, get a loan and buy these pieces of equipment and then charge the patients to be scanned something like less than $1 a scan to do the study. In this way, we provide better care for the patient. We pick up on the economic curve of these community workers who become educated and they earn a living, which is sustainable, and we really drive the overall economy up and certainly address poverty by taking a step in that direction.
I'm glad you asked that question, because it's one of the hidden beauties of this business. We often like to talk about the factories and products and technologies and the competitors and, you know, are your earnings enough? We save lives in this business, and we do it all over the world, and it's nice not to lose sight of that. So thanks for asking that.
Well, the story you talked about is mainly the emerging markets growth, the infrastructure bill in terms of the healthcare in these countries. But if you can talk about the U.S. and the Western European markets, what contribution they would make into that 5-10% revenue growth numbers, which areas are the most growth-worthy areas for you in that 5-10 from the Western world?
You know, as we look around the world, we expect the developing markets, again, very strong in the 20 type of range. You know, as we look out at the U.S., you know, we think that market's going to continue to be stronger than it's been in the past, so be at about a 5 level. In the short term, Europe's looking like something that's 3 or 4 right now. That's kind of how we see the market shaking up. But, you know, every year that sort of changes. Some are up and some are down. But that's the current, that's sort of the current look that we've got. I mean, the other factor there is obviously your competitiveness, the competitiveness of your product line, and your ability to grow the business through share because of products. And, you know, we're not just doing that through, you know, we don't have expectation of gaining share where we are not creating product advantages. So where we think we've got better products or new products, or we've redefined a space, we're driving considerable growth in those areas.
John, on the organic this year, you're trailing the low end of that 5-10% range. You might have thought, you know, with the down year last year, you'd have had a snap back.
Yeah.
What's holding back, you know, the organic this year?
You know, a couple of things. One of them is actually physical. You know, we've had some challenges on the supply chain side with electronics this year. On the revenue side, and as a result, we've still getting some orders, but we're building backlog there. And I think, you know, we'll be walking into next year with a pretty reasonable backlog on a year-over-year basis.
So you might expect next year to be, you know, somewhere in the middle of that range, something like that?
You got the range. I'm not going to change it here. It's going to take Jeff can change my range.
I think in answer to Dean's question, it was somewhat ambiguous when you start to see that acceleration towards the 10% range, and that's what I'm trying to understand better. I mean, back-end loaded.
Right now we're sort of balancing a moderate view of marketplaces, and again, as some of these new products, new technologies, and new markets that we're entering start to take shape, that's where we'll move to the higher end of that range.
It sounds like it's back-end loaded towards the 2014, 12 to 14 area, more than the near term.
That's our growth expectation in the short term. I haven't modeled it out to 2014 or 2015 yet.
And then just lastly, following up on Shannon's question,
yeah.
I think there's a great investor sensitivity across GE generally that when the OE cycle kicks up and growth really kicks up, the operating leverage just isn't there. And I think your response to Shannon's question, I think, kind of validates that. So I wonder if you can just explain a little bit more detail why you lose the operating leverage at the high end of that range.
Some of the leverage that we've just shown is due to some restructuring and cost measures that we've taken in the past year, and we don't expect to be driving that same level of cost out. Still working cost out and working simplification, but not at the same level. Yeah. Cool. Or who? Somebody?
Just following up on the M&A question, it'd be interesting to hear from each of the business leaders as you think through sort of the JVs and home health or partnering with different universities in pathology versus buying Clarient, kind of how you think through the JV structure versus an outright purchase.
Good. I'm going to start philosophically. We don't have an aversion to it either. We tend to, especially in developing markets, we tend to have more of a wholly owned bias. Unless we feel like a partner has... It really can bring us some insights into the marketplace or some distribution advantage, or really can fill a product gap that we have right now that we really don't feel like we have the year or two or basically the time to organically fill that gap. Omar, you could talk a little bit about why Intel and home health.
Yeah, and I think John framed the reason quite well in the sense that Intel really brought technology and expertise as part of their contribution to the JV, which we didn't have. We could have developed it, but they accelerated that move. They've put in, four or five years worth of a lot of research and development in this area, both in terms of technology and in terms of what's needed in that marketplace. But they didn't really have a sense for the market or a critical mass of expertise to go into the healthcare market, which we then provided. So it really was an excellent combination of skill sets, very complementary. This is a brand new space, create a separate JV that can really operate seamlessly and quickly to address that marketplace was also important. So there were some unique factors that drove us to create that JV.
But I'd say as a rule, we're more looking for full ownership or full control in most of them, both from a geographic or a technology standpoint. The JVs would be more the exception.
Two additional questions before I pass it on to John behind me. We've taken over. You can have the mic back later at the end. The first one is, when I asked around sort of the kind of business that defines GE, this is really in reaction to the sale and divestiture of the fire and security business, for example. A lot of discussion around highly scalable, economically scalable, large, highly service-intensive, certainly technology-intensive types of businesses. And I see the technology part, but I'd love to get a little more clarification as you think about biopharma and the move with Clarient, et cetera, particularly since in and of itself I'm not sure when I'll see that actually become accretive, right? But how do I think about a longer-term scalable business model, particularly in that area, and defining how that is also GE?
So I'm not sure I understand.
So the question
can
is,
we scale molecular diagnostics?
Yeah, so if you talk about scaling up this business so it's meaningful and given the price you paid for it, right?
Yeah.
How do you really grow it even faster than you're talking about at sort of the 10%, 8 to 10%?
I'd say the first thing is this is an asset that's scaling quite quickly on its own. CAGR of 65%. That's scaling, I think, technically, right?
Off of what base?
Off of small base, but it's growing rather quickly.
Right.
So it's a $100 million business. But I think the two areas that we really focus on is, one, to expand the market presence. Again, it is a very, very focused business in the U.S. right now. And we think, like the rest of the technologies in our portfolio, it is going to scale globally. The second and probably more important part is by filling the pipeline with more tests. If you look at the in vitro diagnostic space, the emergence of new technologies is extraordinary there. And our ability to build a leadership position in terms of the diagnostic portfolio there is going to be very, very important in scaling it up. And there are going to be synergies from a technology standpoint as we do that.
I would add to this one that this is how we had looked at the market, because this Clarent really gives us access to a platform, and that's really how we had approached it, a platform on which we can build more content. This is actually, that answers also the question of why not a GEV, why do we want to own it? Because based out of that, we now have a model that just looking at the U.S., we can actually scale up by giving more content. Now, we can look at the globalization, but just on the content itself, adding up, and this is where I did not really have time to dig into it, but this molecular pathology project that we have is actually a very nice engine that would create more content. That actually, several pharma, we have a collaboration with Eli Lilly on this one. They are interested in the ability to develop more content, specifically for companion diagnostics, because they're interested in they're interested in having companion diagnostics to be developed at the same time as their targeted drug, but then some labs will need to run the test. And actually having this collaboration in itself is a way to plan for the future growth. The technology we have at the Global Research Center also, we should not undermine the fact that in terms of efficiency, that will also help generate more efficiency and throughput. And that in itself should increase the visibility of what pathology can do to the diagnostics world. So we think that this will in itself expand the market in this dimension also. So we see several dimensions on which the market itself can expand, actually.
Two more?
Okay. I'll be quick.
The question.
All right.
I was wondering, in terms of the data and clinical requirements that you're seeing to get new technologies to market, what are the implications of the 510K regulatory reform, as well as what's going on with needing more data for reimbursement, and what implications does that have for the returns and margins in your business?
Yeah, that's a great question, and we don't know the answer yet, to be honest with you. I mean, they're really looking at the FDA is really looking at changes to the 510 or PMA process, if it goes one way, it could slow down new product introductions. I don't think it's going. They could take longer to get out, but I don't think it's going to change what we do or the long-term economics of any of those product launches. The other thing that we end up doing is launching some of these product technologies in other markets while we're waiting for the U.S. We typically used to launch them in the U.S. and then bring them to the other markets. When things get slower from a regulatory approval process, and Pascal's seen this with DATscan, for example, mm-hmm. and with some of the ultrasound contrast products, we're getting them moving in Japan, Europe, and other parts of the world while we push them through the process in the U.S.
To the amount of data and the amount of sort of R&D or clinical trials, are you having to invest more to get your therapies approved or adopted?
Not yet. Mm-hmm. Not yet.
The only other thing I'd add is, as part of our health imagination focus, to the degree that we require data to be able to have the evidence that we're getting the cost benefit or the quality benefit or the access benefit, those requirements are, in fact, consistent with what we're doing anyway, that we feel is necessary to provide the evidence that's required to meet our health imagination targets.
Yeah. But it is part of the process. It does cost a little bit more. It takes a little bit more time. The Omnix product that Vishal's talking about is going through blind trials, FDA trials right now. That'll take roughly how long?
Roughly about 8 months or so.
Eight months to go through that, and what would it cost? It's not a tremendous cost to go through that process.
No. It's really the institutions that also bear a bunch of that cost because it's in their interest to get that kind of technology out.
Yeah. So it's real. It hasn't completely played out yet. We haven't seen significant changes, but it's something that you do have to pay attention to in this business. But it's gone on all over the world. I mean, you have to get clearance in every market, including China, SFDA on products. One more?
Great. All right, that was my question. Let me ask another one. 3M blamed Obamacare for their segment's lackluster performance. You guys have made a pretty compelling case globally of why your equipment does well over time. What about your services business? Are there incremental pressures you see coming out of healthcare reform here or in other countries that prospectively put pressure on some of those aspects of your businesses over time? Are you seeing anything now?
Obamacare wasn't a big hit to the business. It's really the premise of healthcare. As I said, the discussion about healthcare reform was what really slowed things down because people didn't know what the rules were going to be. But as soon as there was clarity, we saw a bit of a snapback. On the service side of the portfolio, it hasn't made a big difference to the core business. But in the business that Jan talked about, I think it's actually going to really be a driver of demand because in some of the other service businesses, there's more pull from the customer base on productivity solutions. How do you make us more cost-effective? I mean, a real emphasis. And we haven't seen that across the healthcare provider set, with the exception of, there's 5 or 10% there that are very industrial in their thinking and have been using Jan and the team service for quite some time. We're starting to see a lot more interest, a lot more pull on productivity tools, productivity solutions. And I think it's a good thing for Jan. I think it's going to be a good thing for Vishal's business over time because they'll be interested in productivity technologies. What people often blow by, though, is it's going to be very important to Pascal's business, particularly on the molecular diagnostic side, because if you walk through the economics of these cancer treatments, these are very expensive treatments, a lot of these monoclonal antibody-based treatments, and if a $3,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 a month therapy is only effective in 10 or 20% of the population, and you're treating 100% of the population, you're not going to have good economics. If you can for $1,000 or $2,000, recognize that 20% of the population that will respond, you've made a tremendous impact on the cost of the therapy, which is a big part of healthcare economics. And so I think you're seeing a lot more interest on the therapeutic side, and we'll see more interest from a comparative effectiveness side in having diagnostics that can make a real impact on the therapy spend, because most of the money in healthcare is not spent on the diagnostic side. It's actually spent on the therapeutic side. So where we've got better diagnostics, we can be an investment that has a very high yield on the therapy side of the healthcare delivery process. So even when we're doing very high-tech and seemingly expensive things in molecular diagnostics, those are real productivity tools with regard to healthcare, and I think can make a real difference. And that's why we get into that space. So with that, we appreciate your time, your attention. I know this wasn't a high-level, simple discussion. You guys obviously are very familiar with the business, and based on the questions, have a very good understanding of who we are and what we're doing. We appreciate you making the time to be here with us today. So thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, John.